Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Or Even Eagle Flew by Harry Turtledove, narrated by Samantha Dez. Chapter 1. The train from Cleveland to Montreal chugged to a stop at the border between the U.S. and Canada. The woman near the front of the car picked up the plain dealer she'd bought before she got on. The war news from the Low Countries and France was just as lousy now as it had been when she first looked at it a few hours before. She frowned and put the paper back on the seat beside her. She'd just fished Gone with the Wind out of her purse instead when two uniformed American customs men walked into the car from the one ahead of it. They paused in the aisle by her.
"Let me see your papers, ma'am," one of them said.
"Ah, for Christ's sake, Otis!" the other one exploded. "That there's a dame, case you didn't notice. She ain't gonna run off to England to fly planes for the stupid king."
"Never can tell,"
the first customs man, Otis, said.
"She kinda looks like Charles Lindbergh, know what I mean?"
He turned back to the woman.
"Your papers."
Without a word, she handed him her passport. She'd heard the comparison with Lindbergh before and didn't care for it. She happened to know he didn't either. She liked his isolationist America First politics even less. Otis opened the passport to the page with her name and photo.
"Putnam Amelia E.,"
he read, and scribbled on a sheet in his clipboard.
"Purpose of visiting Canada, Mrs. Putnam?"
"Visiting friends," she answered, looking up at him over the tops of her reading glasses. Except on a few formal documents like this, she didn't use her husband's, now her ex-husband's, last name. It came in handy here. Her own would have caused problems.
"Visiting friends."
Otis wrote that down, too. He handed back the passport.
"Enjoy your stay."
"Thank you." As the customs man walked down the aisle, the other one said,
"See, told you so."
"Shut up,"
Otis told him. They checked more passports and lingered longest with two men in their 20s. One tall and carrot-topped, the other medium-sized, with a Clark Gable mustache. The customs man gave the young Americans a much tougher time than they had the woman. Amelia Earhart, the name she used almost all the time, smiled to herself. If the smile seemed sour, then it did, that was all. Those young fellows weren't dames, after all. It was reasonable, even to a customs man, to think they might know something about flying. They had to get their suitcases down from the overhead rack so the inspectors could paw through them. They passed muster, though. The customs men went on to inflict themselves on the next car back from the locomotive. Pretty soon, not soon enough to suit AE, but pretty soon, the train got rolling again. The redhead and the guy who wished he were Clark Gable both let out muffled whoops when they crossed into Canada.
"They aren't as smart as they think they are,"
said the guy with the red hair. They sure aren't, A.E. thought. She picked up Gone with the Wind again. Scarlett was eating grits and dried peas with Aunt Pity Pat, and swearing to herself she'd never touch them again once she had money. A.E. kept reading as the train rolled on to Montreal. Chapter 2. When they reached the station, she grabbed her own small suitcase. She hadn't thought the customs men would search it, and they hadn't, and hurried to the cab rank. Quick as she was, those two young men were quicker. They piled into a taxi and roared away. Well, there were more.
"Where to, madame?"
asked the driver after she got into his Chevy. "The Mount Royal Hotel, please." Something in the way the man looked and talked made her add,
"S'il vous plaît."
He opened his eyes a little wider and smiled.
"Vous parlez français?"
"Je regrette, mais un petit peu."
A.E. had taken French in school, then forgotten most of it till she had to dust it off to try to talk with French officials in Africa on her round-the-world flight. She was glad to get in a little practice here. Where she planned to go, she'd need all she had and then some.
C'est meilleur que rien, the cab driver said. A.E. nodded. Even a little was better than nothing. The cabbie put the car in gear and started for the hotel. The Mount Royal wasn't far from the station. One thing stood out, though, even in that short distance. Unlike the United States, Canada was a country at war. At least half the men on the street wore khaki, RCA navy blue, or the slightly brighter blue of the RCAF. People here looked worried, too, in a way Americans didn't. In the USA, the European war was a noise in another room, nothing to get excited about. Canada was in it up to her eyebrows, and it wasn't going well. Short pants kids on corners sold newspapers whose headlines, in English and in French, shouted about how badly it was going. No more than 15 minutes after the taxi left the station, it pulled up in front of the Mount Royal.
60 cents, ma'am, the driver said, in English, to make sure he wasn't misunderstood.
Here. A.E. gave him a U.S. dollar bill. She hadn't had the chance to change any money. He took it without a word. American and Canadian money were as near on par with each other as made no difference. When he started to make change, she told him, "Don't bother."
"Merci beaucoup," he exclaimed,
pleased back into his first language. He hopped out of the car, hustled around to open her door for her, and hauled her suitcase out of the trunk. A bellhop took it from him before A.E. could. She checked in, got her key, and rode the elevator to the third floor. The key, which had 327 stamped into it, worked in the lock of the room whose door had that number on it. The bellboy set the suitcase on the bed. She gave him a quarter, U.S. again. It fazed him no more than the greenback had bothered the taxi man. He touched a couple of fingers to the edge of his pillbox cap in an almost military salute.
"Thank you, ma'am," he said. "You need anything here, ask for Leon Sprague. That's me."
He tapped his chest. "I will, thanks," she said. Leon Sprague decamped. A couple of minutes later, so did A.E. She'd half hoped someone would have been waiting for her in the lobby. No such luck, though. Instead of summoning the elevator, she walked down the stairs. Somehow, she wasn't all that surprised when she discovered the red-headed young man and his friend with the mustache there ahead of her.
"No messages for either one of us?"
the tall redhead was asking the desk clerk.
"No letters. Not for either one of us."
"I'm very sorry, monsieur."
The hotel man spread his hands in a good facsimile of regret.
"I cannot give you what I do not have." "Nothing from Colonel Sweeney,"
the guy with the mustache persisted. A.E. nodded to herself. Yes, they'd all shown up at the Mount Royal Hotel for the same reason. But the desk clerk shook his head.
"Nothing from anyone," he said firmly.
He did unbend enough to point towards a very small man sitting on a sofa looking at a magazine about flying planes.
"You might inquire of him. He has been asking after messages, too."
By the way the muscle in his cheek twitched, the little guy had been less polite than these two. The redhead and the man with the mustache went over to the short fellow. A.E. drifted that way, too. When the man on the sofa stood up, she saw he wasn't even 5 feet tall.
"Desk clerk says we're on the same boat,"
the redhead said.
"Yeah, the Titanic,"
the short guy said with a sour laugh. He stuck out his hand.
"I'm Vern Keough. Shorty, they call me. Can't imagine why. I'm a pilot and a parachute jumper out of New York. I used to be 5'9" till I landed on my head a couple of times." "Gene Tobin. Red, if you want,"
the tall man said, shaking with the short one. His buddy was Andy Mamedoff. They were both pilots from Los Angeles. A.E. came up to them. "I think I may be in that boat with you, too," she said. They looked her over. She'd seen that look too many times before. "You can't be. You're a woman," it said. But then Mamedoff's eyes widened. She'd seen that happen before, too. He had a few years on the other two, so he might have paid more attention when she was in the news a lot.
You're...
he said, and didn't go on. She nodded. That's right, I'm Amelia Earhart. I aim to fly for the Armée de l'Air, too.
But you're a woman.
Red Tobin pointed out the obvious. I'm a pilot. I'm a darn good pilot, she replied. France is in deep enough, I bet they won't care that I can't pee standing up. And the Nazis are horrible enough, they need stopping from whoever can stop them.
Well, you sure aren't wrong about that,
Mame Doff said.
And if they do let you fly, the publicity will bring more flyers from the States.
A.E. nodded. The same thing crossed my mind. Shorty Keough said,
Now, Colonel Sweeney better come through. Not like I've got cash burning a hole in my pocket.
Tobin and Mame Doff nodded at that. They wouldn't be rich. They were just getting started in life. A.E. had a good deal more money with her than all three of them put together, odds were. Red chuckled without much humor.
When I started talking with Sweeney's people back in L.A., they wanted me to fly for Finland against the Russians. But Finland went belly up, so now it's France against the Nazis.
He shrugged.
They're all so-and-sos.
A.E. judged he would have said something stronger had she been another man. She nodded again anyhow. They are. I don't have much use for war and killing people, but people like Stalin and Hitler won't stop till somebody stops them.
There you go.
Andy Mamedoff made as if to clap his hands.
We aren't gonna be the ones who stop them unless Sweeney's stuff shows up,
Tobin said.
I came this far on promises, but it's not like we can get across the Atlantic on them.
Once more, A.E.'s head bobbed up and down. Thanks to the USA's neutrality rules, going to fight in Europe's latest war could cost Americans their citizenship. A.E. thought she could make a living anywhere in the world, but she had experience and a reputation these young men couldn't hope to match.
If Sweeney's stuff doesn't show up...
Vern Keough made a fist. It wasn't a very big fist, but it summed up what A.E. was thinking, too. A.E. went to the bar with the three young American men. They had a drink, then another one. While they drank, they called down curses on Charlie Sweeney's head. A.E. didn't swear as foully or regularly as her new-met comrades-in-arms, but she had a knack for being funny and insulting without cussing. They seemed to appreciate it.
Didn't know what you were like, for real,
Red Tobin said.
You're okay, though. Better than okay.
The other two men from the States nodded. Thanks, she said. Acceptance warmed her more than the rye did. The bellhop called Leon Sprague came up to them. He carried a tray with four envelopes on it.
You are the Messieurs Tobin, Putnam, Mamedoff, and Keough?
He said. I'm not a monsieur, but I'm Putnam, A.E. said. To the Yanks, she added, married name. The bellboy gave her a dubious look, but $2 cured it. She got her envelope with the others. The envelope held a ticket on the night train to Halifax, Nova Scotia, and a scribbled note. Stay in the station after other people leave. Talk about flying so our man will know you. Be loud. Everyone had a ticket to Halifax, and the same note in almost the same words.
Well, hell, Andy Mamedoff said. If I'd known we weren't going to spend the night, I wouldn't have checked in.
He made wings of his hands and mimed money flying away.
So it goes, Red Tobin agreed, and it has went. Only good news is this joint ain't fancy enough to cost a whole lot.
They took two cabs back to the train station. They might all have fit into one, but their luggage wouldn't. A.E. rode with Tobin. How much flying time do you have? She asked. He laughed sheepishly.
Less than my logbook says I do, but enough to know what I'm doing. Like Shorty said back at the bar, I'll fly in any force except Hitler's or Stalin's.
That's good, A.E. said. It also sounded like a recipe for getting yourself killed, something she didn't mention. Nobody became a fighter pilot in the hope of living a long, quiet life. Most of the people on the train to Halifax were Canadian soldiers in khaki. When they found out A.E. and her friends were American, they asked the same question over and over again. Why isn't the United States in the war? Don't blame us, A.E. and the men said over and over and over again. She didn't think it did much good. When the train pulled into Halifax, the soldiers and the Canadian civilians had places to go. The four Americans hung around on the platform. As instructed, they chattered loudly about planes and flying. After an hour or so, a short, squat man in a trench coat who jammed the brim of his fedora down low over his eyes walked up to them. A cigarette dangled from the corner of his mouth. He couldn't have looked more like a movie spy if he'd come straight from Central Casting.
"You are the Americans?"
he said in a heavy French accent.
"Not us. We're a church group from Melbourne, Australia,"
Red said. A.E. kicked him in the ankle. "We're the Americans," she said quickly. "Don't worry about him. He likes to make jokes." The man in the trench coat shrugged.
"It matters not. If he shoots down the bush, if you all shoot down the bush, that matters. Come with me, s'il vous plaît."
He led them through back rooms at the station and through dripping alleys. He acted like a movie spy trying to shake off a tail. At last, in a bare room lit by a dim bulb, he opened a safe and handed each of them a manila envelope.
"Travel documents and money," he said.
After A.E. opened the envelope's metal clasp, she found it held 2,500 francs and a safe conduct from the French Consul General in Montreal with her photo and physical characteristics. It stated she was of indeterminate nationality, but should be permitted to enter France. Jordy Keogh held up his new bankroll.
"How much is this in dollars?"
"About 50.
The guy with the fedora answered unwillingly.
"Now, you should go to the harbor. The Gengar sails at 7.
A.E. eyed her watch. It was already past 3. By the time they got to the harbor, dawn was breaking. The Gengar was a rust bucket freighter, part of a convoy bound for France. A.E. recognized the stench floating out of her hold. "I'll be darned if she's not hauling mules," she said.
"Whole lot of mules,"
Red Tobin agreed. None of the sailors spoke English. The skipper did, a little. He had room for only 2 of them. Mamedoff and Keogh stayed. A.E. left with Tobin. They found spaces on another equally grimy freighter, the Pierre LD. A.E. got a cabin all to herself. It was just about big enough to turn around in as long as you were careful. Red bunked in the same kind of cabin, only he shared it with 3 other guys. As soon as the convoy left the harbor and started zigzagging across the Atlantic, A.E. discovered a new reason to prefer flying. She had a strong stomach. She'd been airsick only a handful of times. The Atlantic's roll and pitch, though, proved too much for her. She did not enjoy the first couple of days at sea very much. After that, the ocean got milder, or she got used to it. She could visit the galley without rushing to the head or the rail as soon as she finished eating. They had a phonograph. Red played American records. The platters the French sailors spun were all about the war.
"You can tell why they fight, that's for sure," Tobin said,
and he didn't speak a word of French. A.E. nodded. "You can," she agreed. "If only they were doing better." The little news they got at sea came from the shortwave radio. Her French was improving with practice, but still wasn't good. Neither was any of the news. Chapter 3. German U-boats were on everyone's mind. A British destroyer escorting the convoy depth-charged what it thought was one. Every sailor on the Pierre LD stayed at action stations for hours afterwards. No torpedoes tore into the freighters, though. 2 weeks after leaving Halifax, the convoy steamed into Saint-Nazaire. A.E. and Red met up with Shorty and Mamedoff on the pier. The other Americans' travel had been every bit as delightful as theirs. They'd hardly got off the docks before they realized everything in France had gone to hell while they crawled across the Atlantic. This wasn't just a country fighting a war. It was a country losing a war, and losing badly. No one in Saint-Nazaire had time for four Americans washed up on the lee shore of disaster. At last, they found a harried official who grudged them half an hour he clearly resented.
"I can give you train tickets to Paris, but the train does not depart until Monday," he said. "Until then, I can put you up here."
He sighed.
"I suppose I can put you up here."
Only they didn't leave Monday. The French bureaucrats gave them 3 more days of grief.
"Why should we help you?"
the last one said.
"According to your documents, your nationality is indeterminate. What are you?"
"We're Americans. You know damn well we're Americans," Red Tobin snapped. His patience had worn very thin. So had A.E.'s.
"You have no passports,"
the Frenchman said.
"Our government won't let us travel to a war zone on 'em," Shorty Keogh said.
"I do. They don't worry about me." A.E. produced hers. The functionary gave it a fishy stare.
"What are you doing with these men, Madame Putnam?"
What his accent did to her married name was a caution.
"Are you their mother?"
"I'm a pilot, same as they are," she answered, as evenly as she could. "Putnam is my ex-husband's last name. Mine is Earhart." He needed a couple of seconds before that sank in.
"Nom de nom,"
he muttered, and then,
"You are the famous Amelia Earhart?"
"That's me." A.E. didn't like to trade on her fame, but it came in handy every so often. "So, how about you let us have those tickets for Paris we're supposed to get?" She didn't know whether the ploy would work, but they were on the next train to the French capital.
"Gotta hand it to you, ma'am," Andy Mamedoff said as they squeezed into a crowded car.
"That was terrific."
"Thanks," A.E. said. "And for God's sake, call me Amelia. Otherwise, I'll think we've got that damned French pencil pusher along with us." He grinned at her.
"You're okay, you know that?"
"Well, I try," she said, just as the train began to move. From Saint-Nazaire to Paris was about 200 miles. The train seemed to stop every half hour or so. One of the stops, at Le Mans, was very bad. A westbound train had also stopped on the track next to theirs. Half the cars had been shot up from the air. They were pocked with bullet and shell holes. Only a few windows still had glass in them. And half the French soldiers in the cars looked to have been shot up, too. They were bloody. They were bandaged. Their faces were pale and full of pain. A fellow with a Red Cross armband tenderly helped a wounded man smoke a cigarette.
"Nazi bastards,"
Mamedoff ground out.
"If we spotted a German troop train or a column of trucks,"
Red Tobin said slowly.
"It's war. This is what we signed up for."
A.E. had thought about shooting down enemy pilots in 109s or 110s or bombers. She hadn't thought about shooting up luckless foot soldiers, who might not even be able to shoot back. But Red was right. That also came with the job. After a mournful toot from the whistle, the train rolled on toward Paris. The hotel in the City of Light was, not to put too fine a point on it, a flea bag. Tobin, Keogh, and Mamedoff shared a room. It had one narrow bed. How they decided who got to use it, A.E. didn't know. She had a room to herself. It was bigger than her cabin on the Pierre LD, but not much. An almost equally thin bathroom lurked down at the end of the hall. No one slept the night after they got in. German planes bombed Paris. What sounded like every anti-aircraft gun in the world tried to shoot them down. A bomb hit no more than 150 yards from the hotel. The noise was like the end of the world.
The building jumped as if someone had kicked it in the behind. A.E.'s window rattled but didn't blow in. Next morning, over croissants and strong coffee at a cafe around the corner, Red managed a crooked grin.
"Boy, that was fun," he said.
"Merde."
Andy Mamedoff had started picking up French. That word and others like it came in handy when the Americans tried to get any Armée de l'Air officials to pay attention to them. They didn't have much luck. In a way, A.E. understood it. The Germans were surging forward everywhere. Paris itself looked like falling soon. The British and French troops who hadn't made it across the Channel to England had surrendered to the Nazis. In the face of catastrophe, who could get excited about a few possible pilots? All the same, least they can do is give us a medical exam and put us in planes. Shorty Keogh groused. How can we do any worse than they're doing already? They haven't got time for us, A.E. said. We're uninvited guests in a house where someone's dying.
Where everybody's dying,
Red Tobin amended. And she didn't try to tell him he was wrong. She did say, "Something I've seen in French planes you guys need to remember. You pull the throttle out for more power and push it in for less, right?"
"Sure,"
Andy Mamedoff said. Shorty and Red nodded. "Sure, if it's an American plane or an English one or even one from Germany," A.E. said. "France and Italy do it backwards. With airplanes, you push the throttle in for more juice and pull it out to ease back. You can kill yourself if you forget. I almost did once."
"Thanks," Red said. "That's worth knowing, all right." "If we ever get into a French plane, it will be anyhow,"
Shorty said.
"This country is going down the drain,"
Mamedoff said, and nobody tried to contradict him either. He went on.
"I came over here to fight the goddamn Nazis, not to surrender to them. None of us has proper papers. Except Amelia, I mean,"
Red said. Mamedoff exhaled through his nose.
"Papers are the least of my worries if the Germans catch us."
He was Jewish. He didn't make a big deal out of it, but the Gestapo wouldn't care about that. A couple of days later, they finally did get called in for medicals. The doc who examined A.E. was short and dumpy and bald with a fringe of gray. He spoke some English. Along with her bits of French, they managed to understand each other. Before long, she wasn't sure she wanted to.
"You are something out of the ordinary," he remarked.
"I'm a pilot. I'm a good pilot. If I ever get the chance, I can help France," she said.
"France?"
He waved that aside.
"France, c'est mort."
France is dead. It wasn't a thought A.E. hadn't had herself, but she hated hearing it from a Frenchman. She also hated the way the guy's hands wandered. It wasn't the first time that kind of thing had happened, but it was the first time in quite a while.
"Watch yourself, Charlie," she snapped.
"If you are friendly, I promise you will pass the medical," he said.
"Friendly, huh? I'm going to pass the medical, or I'm going to beat the living crap out of you. Your choice. How about that?" At 5'8", she was at least 3 inches taller than he was. She was also in much better shape. She figured she could do exactly what she threatened. By the way he licked his lips, by the way his eyes widened behind his steel-framed spectacles, so did he.
"You don't have to be so masculine about it," he said.
"Just make sure my papers look the way they're supposed to. I know enough Francais to catch you if you try to pull a fast one, too." A.E. hoped she was right. That masculine made her want to laugh more than it made her mad. It wasn't the first time she'd got called a dyke, nowhere close. Way too much of the world thought any woman who tried to get ahead in a man's profession had to be butch. Despite passing their medicals, the Americans kept not getting sent anywhere that had airplanes.
Andy and Shorty in red went out and got magnificently smashed.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?